After securing qualification for the 2022 World Cup, the U.S. men's national team are trying to figure out what it's going to take to give them the best opportunity at the World Cup in November. In order to do that, there's two tune-up windows. The first one in June and the last one further on in the fall before we actually get to see the team line up in Qatar. In order to assess kind of how World Cup qualifying went and what we can expect in Qatar, I brought in a man who I think he has an interesting perspective whenever it comes to the U.S. men's national team because he has a YouTube channel that's significantly bigger than this one, by the way, that covers the world game, that covers soccer. I mean, he just released a video on China. He released a video on Canada, and he covers the European soccer scene as well as anyone out there. He is Maxwell. Maxwell, thank you for coming on. Thank you for being here. Thank you for accepting this this call into the Yank Report.
No, thank you for having me, man. Thank you.
So the first thing I want to ask you is, I know that you've done some videos on the U.S. men's national team. I've seen your passion. I've seen your fandom. But I want to know, like, kind of where are you at with the national team as far as, like, your soccer diet? Are you paying attention to, like, Weston McKennie's games at Juventus? Are you paying attention to Christian Pulisic at Chelsea or even further down the list, like Luca De La Torre at Heracles? Or are you just kind of watching the games, the World Cup qualifying games?
I like to just watch, like, the World Cup qualifying games. I follow the players to an extent. Like, social media will just kind of flood my my inbox with, like, you know, Pulisic updates, Weston McKennie, all that kind of stuff. So I get, like, a little bit of that. But for the most part, all of my U.S. soccer just comes from the qualifiers and just the friendlies and all that.
And that's exactly why I want to talk to you. I'm really excited for this conversation because in this U.S. soccer world that I live in, we tend to all be fanatics about this team and about these players, and we watch them wherever they play. But the rest of the country, the majority of American soccer fans are more similar to you, where they watch the top teams, they watch the teams that they care about and the players that they're passionate about. They do watch the qualifiers and the big games that the U.S. is in, but they're not, you know, watching Mallorca games with the hope that, you know, Matthew Hoppe can get in the last 10 minutes of the game, you know, that type of thing. So I'm excited to talk to you about that. The first thing I want to ask you, though, is I know you released a video about your thoughts on World Cup qualifying. It's been a few months since then. What are your thoughts about the U.S.'s performance throughout World Cup qualifying and sort of how far this team can go?
So in terms of, like, how we performed in the qualifiers, we were pretty underwhelming. I knew that from the start it was going to be a struggle because this is a very young team, and going through CONCACAF qualifiers completely different from the Gold Cup or just any friendly in general. But still, I just felt it was a lot more underwhelming. There's just a lot of inconsistency. And the more I thought about it over the months after that video, I kind of see this pattern in where the US team is never the same, or to an extent, the same squad every single match. And when you can only play three matches every month or so, even like there's a gap of maybe 2 months, right? It kind of messes up with the chemistry. And I think that's a problem that we've had, especially because I feel like no other team does what Greg Berhalter would do in Panama, for example, right? We don't just completely switch up the team unless we truly have trust in them, unless these are players that, you know, we can trust to an extent when it comes to experience and all kinds of things like that.
Our partners at BetOnline continue to be your number one source for all your betting needs and sports info. Find all the latest sports developments, including the latest odds on the NBA playoffs, fights, and even next season's futures. And don't forget that the MLB is back as well. Who are you picking to win the World Series? BetOnline is your continued source for all your sports wagering needs, including live betting and your favorite Vegas casino and poker games. It's super easy to get started, so head to the website today or use your mobile device to join or use our promo code BELIEVE, that's BLEAV, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, where the game starts. Well, I want to know what kind of your expectations were coming into World Cup qualifying. What did you think that the group was going to do versus how did they actually do?
It was kind of hard to tell because there was the Gold Cup where things were a little tacky here or there. Same thing with the Gold Cup. We didn't really even play like the full strength squad. It still gave me a little bit of false hope because I was thinking, okay, well, if we can win with our Z team, surely we can do pretty well in the qualifiers. But it really just wasn't the case. It just wasn't realistic. You know, the Gold Cup, as I said before, it's comparing that to CONCACAF qualifiers, completely different there. So in terms of my expectations, they just dropped pretty much after that first match against El Salvador. they dropped even more once the Honduras match happened. Even if we did win 4-1, we were still, I think, probably one of the worst halves I'd ever seen in a while, was that first half against Honduras. You can still see this team improving over the last couple of windows, and that's what we like to see, but it's just, you see a little bit of improvement here or there, and then you just see all of a sudden this giant divot. Like, we had Mexico versus the U.S. I feel like a lot of that tension just came from the patriotism and just the rivalry in general that really boosted us up to winning that match. And then you go to Jamaica, where we were so bad. There was no identity whatsoever, and that's another problem. We've gone through the last few years with Greg Berhalter, and I still can't really define his identity besides just bump the ball up to the wings where there's no one in the middle to cross to in the first place. Like, another thing is, right, we don't have a proper number nine. We thought we did with Ricardo Pepi, but, you know, I feel like that's still going to take some time. He's 18 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you articulated a lot of sort of my reflections on World Cup qualifying. And yeah, after Nations League and Gold Cup and the successes there, we were really hoping to build on that and come out strong. And that first game against El Salvador really slapped us in the face. But looking at the totality of World Cup qualifying and sort of how we got here from there, I think you hit the nail on the head as far as not having the same unit throughout World Cup qualifying, and more specifically, missing some significant pieces throughout World Cup qualifying. If you look at how many games actually Weston McKennie played in, I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it was around 8 games, which is roughly, I don't know, 60% of the games of World Cup qualifying. So for 40% of the games, we were missing Weston McKennie, who I think whenever he played was a key player. We got, I believe we got one start out of Gio Reyna with a few substitute appearances. And whenever you look at the impact that player could have had throughout World Cup qualifying, just an absolute tremendous loss. Christian Pulisic, a lot of his minutes were substitute minutes. He did have some starts, but we didn't really see the Christian Pulisic we wanted to see until very late in World Cup qualifying. And then there's, you know, the rotation at center back. We lost goalkeepers throughout World Cup qualifying. Sergiño Dest was kind of there and not there. Then there's players, the teenagers that kind of came into the group that took some time. Ricardo Pepi is a great example of one who kind of hit the scene hot and then kind of cooled off, which is something you'd expect from an 18-year-old, but it's also an 18-year-old that we relied on tremendously. Same could be said for kind of Yunus Musa. It took Musa a few games to kind of get into the swing. I thought that he was an absolute asset throughout World Cup qualifying, but we kind of got lucky with that one because that's not going to be the norm whenever you play a lot of young players. And then you look at the totality of this team, how young this team is, and sort of some of the structural issues that the team has, where, like you said, there is no number nine for this team. And then you kind of look at what the results say or what the results were, which is that the U.S. I think that the U.S. was number one in expected goals throughout World Cup qualifying, but they were down a few of those expected goals, and those missing a few of those expected goals will play out in some of these very tight windows where we're either tying by one goal or losing by one goal and missing a lot of chances. And that lack of a goal score in a number nine really shows through. And these are all issues that I think are structural within the team, that there's just nothing anybody can do about. There's nothing that anybody can do to make our players older and more experienced. And there's nothing that anybody can do to make Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams, and Yunus Musa play more games together. There's nothing we can do to get Gio Reyna on the field. And there's nothing we can do to have some type of Champions League level number nine. We can't just do that. However, there has been a ton of criticism of the coach, Greg Berhalter. I know in your video, you had some pretty scathing remarks on Greg. What were your thoughts on Greg throughout World Cup qualifying and kind of what he brought to the team?
It was just the same old I've seen time and time again. You just never saw any distinct improvements, as I said before, across multiple windows that I felt like I had a little bit of confidence I could see after, you know, the Gold Cup and stuff, because even then you can get used to CONCACAF qualifiers a little bit, kind of get a gist of how they work out and build upon that. I just never really saw that from Greg Berhalter, and that's just why I was so frustrated with him. And of course, the other outside things where it's just the arrogance of just the U.S. Soccer Federation in general just really comes out, where, you know, Greg Berhalter took selfies with fans at the Honduras match. Like, do that after the match, man. Like, I'm sure they can stay there for another 10 minutes because I think it was 80 minutes played, right? Just do that after the match, because doing that during the match, it's just arrogance. It's just no respect for your opponent whatsoever. It's just stuff like that that I feel like also adds to the constant issues with this team over the many years, in all honesty. Just that arrogance, it still lingers even though we didn't even qualify 4+ years ago.
So how much of that kind of the off the field stuff with Greg Berhalter contributes to your dislike of the coach? I know people point to there's the insistence on keeping guys like Jackson Yule and Sebastian Legette around throughout like the Gold Cup, even though they kind of proven that they weren't contributing to the team in a real way. Same can be said for someone like Christian Roldan and the interview that he gave where he called Christian Roldan a glue guy, and that frustrated a lot of fans. There's the incident with Weston McKennie getting suspended in Nashville and kind of the mystery that surrounded that. There's the selfie. There's the bounce passes. There's kind of just the way that he carries himself and the demeanor. There's the verticality statements. There's the slideshows where he always talks about changing the way the world sees American soccer. I mean, there's so many of these little things that sort of stick in the craw for American soccer fans. Do these things contribute to your dissatisfaction with the product that you see from him on the field?
I think it just depends on the magnitude of the situation. Like the selfies, yeah, that kind of pissed me off. Would I contribute that to is like, you know, tactics? Probably not. But say something like the statements he made after the Canada match where we dominated, right? How many shots we have in that match? Like, not many. Because I mean, Canada just stood back and defended, and we just held the ball for pretty much the entire time, but we didn't do anything with it. So, you know, those kind of comments really just make me lose hope. You know, it's not the selfie stuff that makes me lose hope. It's those kind of comments like that, the Christian Roldan stuff, just the fact that he plays his favorites, even though they don't do anything.
Now, I speaking of Canada, you just did a video on the rise of Canada. Great video. I checked that one out. Can you kind of compare and contrast the Canadian team at present that was able to have great results against the U.S. and Mexico throughout World Cup qualifying, finished first in World Cup qualifying, versus the U.S., which finished third in World Cup qualifying, despite having this wonderful group of talent? What are the differences between this Canadian national team and this American national team right now?
I think one is the lack of leadership in the U.S. team. You know, I feel like you have Atiba Hutchinson always in the center or someone of that stature for Canada, right? Because a leader is so important. I mean, to throw this back to the Arsenal matches I just watched like the last 2 weeks, there was no leader on the pitch. We've been terrible because of it. And I think that's another problem with the U.S. team, which is they're so young as a core. I don't think there's really any particular leader at the moment. You know, I feel like Christian Pulisic is the captain, but can you really consider him a leader type captain? You know?
Yeah, there's guys like Walker Zimmerman and Tyler Adams who are often pointed to as the leaders of the team. But compare that to a guy like Atiba Hutchinson, who he leads the Canadian national team in caps. I mean, he's been the guy for Canada for so long. He's got all the skins on the wall. He's played in Europe for a number of years. I mean, whenever he walks into the locker room, his presence is felt, and there's nobody questioning his authority over that group. And you compare that to the U.S. national team, there's just nobody like that. There's just, I mean, it would take like a Landon Donovan type of figure to be in the mix to kind of compare to what Atiba Hutchinson's done for Canada. And there's just nobody in that group. So how does the U.S. kind of, how do we, I don't know.
And then another thing is just, I feel like there's a larger brotherhood, like a closer brotherhood for the Canadian team than there is the U.S. It just feels that way. And John Herdman, it seems like every single match they win, he just isn't satisfied enough. He wants more. And you compare his interviews to Greg Berhalter's, there's such a massive difference. But as you were saying, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought up John Herdman because there's rumors now connecting John Herdman to bigger and bigger jobs across world soccer. He's kind of become a superstar. Just quickly, in your research for the Canadian national team, what were your thoughts on John Herdman and what makes him so special?
He's just, I think, alongside being a tactician, a really good tactician, knows when to change it up, knows how to do things differently to adapt to the game. He's also really good as a mental coach. He knows the game in and out when it comes to just the mentality you want to have playing this sport. And that was very much proven when he took over the women's team. They were broken. They had just came back from losing every single match in the 2011 World Cup, I'm pretty sure. And he took that team and brought them to two bronze medals and a quarterfinal finish in the 2015 World Cup. And he brought all that onto the men's team, where his first goal was to break the, I guess, the goal scored record against U.S. Virgin Islands. And everyone, or like not everyone, but some of the people in that squad didn't really feel right about that. They just felt like it wasn't possible. But John Herdman stuck to his guns there. And I think just having that bullish attitude towards the game, being able to motivate your players properly, and always being hungry is what'll get you above pretty much most of the international coaches we have here.
Yeah, it's hard not to be impressed by John Herdman whenever you hear him speak and you see the way that his players speak about him, not to mention the results that he's gotten, where he's kind of come into this World Cup qualifying, this World Cup qualifying cycle, which was supposed to be the coming out party for this new generation of American superstars, and just kind of crashed the party. Slapped Mexico around down in Mexico, beat up on the U.S. in Nashville, and then beat both of them up in Canada. I mean, just a remarkable job. Now, I don't want to stay too much on Canada, but Canada has a really tough draw in the World Cup. I think they have Belgium and they have Croatia. Do you think they have a chance of getting out of their group?
I honestly think so, because, I mean, John Herdman, as I said, exceptional coach, knows what to do in these types of situations. It's going to be difficult because, I mean, it is Belgium and Croatia. But I will say about Belgium, and I'm going to stick to my guns here for the rest of the year here. I don't think Belgium are going to do well in this World Cup. It's just, in general, a very old core. And when you're playing like 96-year-old Toby Alderweireld and all those defenders, I don't see much hope for that team. I feel like they're going to be the ones that crash out. Like, they're one of the favorites to crash out. I think the golden generation's dead. So I just think from that, I think Canada has a pretty good chance there. It will be difficult, though, because, you know, there's Croatia still. Morocco's a pretty good team, too. People kind of forget about Morocco. Hakimi and Nasiri, although he's not really in great form right now. But anything can change in the World Cup.
Yeah, and I mean, to your point, there's been a lot of cases of formerly great national teams that are getting a little bit up there in age, relying on players that are a bit too old and crashing and burning. I mean, it happened to Spain. It happened to Germany. It's happened to a lot. Portugal, whenever the U.S. beat them, I think in 2002, I think was along those lines. It's very possible, and that would be a great story. Now, you bring up Morocco, which is a tremendous segue.
Oh, yeah,
because
that's right.
The U.S. is going to be taking on Morocco in this June window, where it's going to be two friendlies, one against Morocco, one against Uruguay, and then one against the Nations League against Grenada and El Salvador. So this is going to be an opportunity for Greg to, he called it a fine-tuning window, one where he can get more playing time with some of the core guys, but also an opportunity to see a couple of new players. We know that Cameron Carter-Vickers from Celtic is going to be coming in. We know that Haji Wright, who's tearing it up in the Turkish league, is going to be coming in. And those are the players that we know are going to be coming in. We know that John Brooks is likely not to be a part of this group. We know that Ricardo Pepi's likely not to be a part of this group. But there's also a mystery dual international that's going to be coming in. And outside of that, we don't really know. We're hoping that some other players come in, but we don't really know. What are kind of your hopes and expectations from this particular June window that's going to help the U.S. In November?
I just want to see, in general, some team building. I think that's just really what you can do in these types of situations. Take advantage of these friendlies, use different players that you may have not used before, like what we could have done in earlier friendlies before the World Cup qualifiers. We could avoid situations like Panama. I feel like these are matches that we can experiment a lot more and just see what these new players can provide us, you know, what if we can put them in the system or even maybe build the system around them a little bit, you know? The one thing that I'm a little curious, though, is there's usually friendlies also before the World Cup, and that's where you can kind of get the squad together and really know what the game plan is before everything. I have no idea if that's going to happen this World Cup because it's all the way in the winter. There's going to be clubs playing prior. So that'll be really interesting to see what happens there. If there are friendlies before them, that's when I think we should probably play like our main squad. A little bit of experimentation here or there, but for the most part, focus on the experimentation in this window.
Well, I can answer that question. There's not going to be friendlies before the World Cup. But yeah, you're right. There's usually like a little send-off tournament. And that's not just for the U.S., but that's for clubs all around the world. But in this particular case, since the World Cup's going to be in the middle of the European season, I think there's going to be like a two-week pause before. And then that's whenever teams are going to go off to the World Cup. But there's not expected to be any friendlies or anything like that taking place. So for the U.S., it's this June window. And then we have another window in the fall. And that's it. That's all we got before the World Cup. So this is our second-to-last opportunity to get it right, to figure things out before the World Cup. With all that being said, one of the players that I'm really excited about coming into this window is Jesus Ferreira. I think he's the leading goal scorer in MLS right now. He had an okay World Cup qualifying cycle. I'm just curious about your thoughts on Jesus Ferreira and your thoughts on just MLS in general as a league that can contribute players to the U.S. men's national team.
I know you've hyped up Jesus Ferreira a lot. I've seen that on Twitter quite a bit. I like him as a player. I think his positioning is great from what I've seen. I think in the matches he played a little too deep because every single time he crossed in the ball, he always was a little bit too behind. And of course, he should probably work on his finishing a little bit. In those qualifiers, again, just there were some chances that should have gone in and it just didn't.
Yeah.
But
there was one against El Salvador and there was one against Panama that come to mind as missed opportunities for Jesus.
So, yeah, I mean, I think he should definitely get another chance at it. He's done really well in the MLS. your question about the MLS, right? Like, what was it again?
Yeah, so what do you think about MLS as a league, really, in general, as it compares to Europe? How do you think that, do you think that MLS players are of quality to be playing for the national team? Just kind of your thoughts on that whole discussion.
I think so, in some regards. I feel like the game in MLS is improving year after year. It's starting to kind of tear away from that retirement title that we've had for however many years. There's still obviously those players, but you're starting to see a lot more emphesis on youth, which
is what you like. The big news today is that Lionel Messi might be heading to MLS at the end of the 2023 season. So that's something. But anyway,
Messi saying he's going to Miami. He's lying. He's lying. I got contacts. He's going to Charlotte. but yeah, I think I'm really excited for the MLS just because I don't really watch it too much. I don't follow it too much. I just follow like Charlotte FC because they're my local team now. But I do like how there's an emphasis on youth. There's a lot more just coming out. And it's exciting when a league has all this youth talent that is kind of taking over the scene. It's really exciting for both the U.S. soccer fans who are seeing the future of the game, not only just for one single generation, but for more, potentially, but also just in general for more of the new fans coming in. You know, they're seeing some players that they'll see grow into the game, grow into the league and potentially become stars overseas. I think that's the one thing the U.S. Soccer Federation has always been lagging behind with is the MLS. It's just always been not really focusing on youth. It's always been focusing more on image, you know, like we've been a retirement league for so many years. But now it's kind of, as I said before, it's going away and we're starting to see more youth.
In the U.S. soccer world, the discussion is fairly black and white generally. It's like MLS is either the worst thing ever or it's great. I think it's somewhere in between. Like you said, I think whether or not a player is good enough for the national team that's coming out of MLS, I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think some are going to be good enough and some aren't. And I think a lot of that has to do with the depth at that particular position. I mean, there's guys like Jordi Mihailovic, who is having a MVP caliber season over in Montreal for MLS, but he's playing in a position at winger, or where he would potentially play at winger for the national team. That's a position of strength for the national team, and there's not really a spot for him. Whereas at striker, that's a position without a lot of depth, where nobody's really stepped up. So a guy like Jesus Ferreira, potentially a guy like Brandon Vasquez, could potentially step into that spot. Those same could be said for Haji Wright or Ricardo Pepi or whoever else is out there. I look at a position like backup left back as kind of the same situation. Anybody who steps up and claims that spot could be good. I don't think that every MLS player is great. I don't think that every MLS player is bad. I think it should be a lot more of a case-by-case basis. But I'm curious for you, who's obviously a soccer fanatic, what's it been like having actual professional soccer close by in Charlotte, where you can actually go to the games and enjoy a team that's in your backyard?
It's pretty sick, I can't lie. Although my wallet gets bled dry because there's like, it's a complete car culture in Charlotte. I have to drive like 30 miles down to see the game and then park for like $40. But I really enjoyed it. I finally got to be in the depths of the actual supporter section last weekend. That was a ton of fun, just sing a bunch of chants, all that kind of stuff. But just in general, like the culture here in Charlotte when it comes to soccer has just been phenomenal. Like I didn't expect anything like this before. Prior to Charlotte FC becoming a thing, everyone was banking on Raleigh to be the soccer city in North Carolina, because it was closer to the so-called triangle, where it's like UNC, Duke, NC State, really good soccer programs there. And also the Charlotte scene just didn't really seem that passionate. At one point there was like a rally in 2017 called MLS to CLT, and it only had 20 people. It was a laughing stock for the rest of the Twitter night. But for some reason, all that's changed, which I'm really grateful for. I'm glad I don't have to drive 2 hours to see a local team. I can just drive 30 miles. But, you know, it's been fun. I've never had this experience before. And just seeing the game grow before my own eyes, it's really beautiful, because I would have never expected this when I was like 10 years old.
Yeah, access to soccer is so damn cool. I mean, I grew up in a world where MLS didn't exist, and I got to see it actually start and actually grow. And just to have so many people now have such access to the game in their own towns and their own communities is so cool. One of the fascinating things for me in starting this YouTube channel is, like, you know, I'm from Louisiana. Louisiana is certainly not a soccer crazy state. And I always assumed that there just weren't a lot of people out there that knew much about the national team or cared or anything like that. And it's been remarkable to me, like, in growing the channel, seeing people comment like, hey, I'm from Louisiana. Hey, I'm people that live in my hometown that know, like, my small hometown of like 200,000 people actually like watch the channel. And it's just been crazy to find out that there are so many of us out there, even though it feels like there's not a lot, even though like in high school, I didn't really get to talk about this stuff with anybody. There's a lot of people out there that care about this stuff. And it's so cool to see the living, breathing embodiment of that. Whenever you see like the opening game for Charlotte, or you see the Nashville opening their new stadium, and just the amount of support that they have there, and you know, games in Austin and stuff like that. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to go to many U.S. men's national team games, but just seeing the amount of support, seeing how much the fans know about the game and know about the players and how passionate they are, it's just an awesome experience all the way around.
Yeah, I think just the coolest thing is, like, I think your generation saw the beginning of it. Mine kind of jumped into it during like World Cup 2010, so on. There was always a wall, though. I feel like there was just never enough broadcasting of games, even like European games over here for the longest of time. And now it just seems like everything is that, I mean, it's available. It's all available. It's very easy to reach, whether legally or illegally. But I'm so happy for the next generation who just get to experience this. They won't feel lost. They won't feel like there's an area where you can't celebrate this sport. You know, you can.
Yeah, that's true. That's true for fans and for players as well. Players that are coming up in this game, in this country, have opportunities. I mean, they may not have as many opportunities as if they were born in like Rio or Madrid or something like that. But kind of depending on where you are in this country, the web is growing. It used to be, you know, whenever I was coming up, if you weren't from like Southern California, New York, New Jersey, Florida, and Texas were like the hotspots for soccer. I mean, good luck getting to the highest levels. But now there's kids coming from all over the place that are getting access, getting opportunities. You know, the famous story with Clint Dempsey. Clint Dempsey was just inducted into, I think, the Seattle Sounders Hall of Fame. He would have to drive 6 hours from Nacogdoches, Texas, to Dallas multiple times a week to play, to get the best coaching and to get access to the quality of soccer that he needed in order to grow as a professional. And you saw that, how that turned out for him. Well, today there might be some people out there who have to drive 6 hours, but the amount of people is closing tremendously. There's access to quality coaches, professional coaches. It's just growing. And like you said, I'm really excited for this next generation, this just generation that's getting started right now, this generation that's coming up, seeing players like Christian Pulisic, Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams at the highest levels, seeing players like Ricardo Pepi start off in Dallas and then get massive moves over to Europe, and then being able to go to their local MLS clubs and seeing passionate fan bases, packed houses, people who really care about the sport. It's remarkable. We got to move on. We've been talking about MLS for too long. I want to talk about the World Cup. It's the thing that everybody cares about. It's the thing that we're all circling. It's the thing that we've been waiting for 8 years since that dreadful night in Cuba, which, if you don't know much about that story, Maxwell did a tremendous job kind of recounting that whole World Cup qualifying cycle and every little painful detail of it. But the U.S. is going to they have qualified for the World Cup in Qatar. Now what? Now, how are they going to actually do in Qatar? What are kind of your thoughts on the squad and what expectations we can have for this group in Qatar?
I don't particularly have much hope for us in this World Cup. I think I've been kind of on this for a bit. I feel like we might actually have a decent chance against England. I know people will think I'm crazy there, but I only believe that because it's going to be such a patriotic match. I mean, one, it's Black Friday. No one's doing anything. Everyone is going to be watching that match. And I mean, it's just England versus the US. We've been facing each other since 1776 and beyond. So something tells me just all of that can actually bump this team to maybe a draw, maybe a win. If we win, that'll be the greatest day of my life. Outside of that, though, I don't know if I can really see anything else. I have a feeling that Ukraine's probably going to be that last spot. And Iran, I would not sleep on Iran, man. Very good team. There's some star players like Mehdi Taremi. Sardar Azmoun is really good for the national team. Not so much club team, but he hasn't really gotten too many chances for Leverkusen, so we'll just have to see there. But just in general, it's a really good core of young and old players, very solid keeper. I think we have a chance there, but I feel like Iran would get the better of us there. And then Ukraine, I feel like just seeing their war-torn country is enough to really have a fire in their heart to go pretty far in the World Cup, in all honesty. So honestly, I don't see us getting out of the group stages. I hope. I really do hope. But I just don't see it.
Yeah, I can't fault you for that thought, man. I mean, looking at this team that we have and just how young they are and how inconsistent they've been, it's hard to really assume that they're going to be anything other than inconsistent once they get to the World Cup. And coming up against these teams, like you said, I mean, everybody's pointing to this England game as sort of as one that the U.S. can go out and get based on just American exceptionalism, where we always feel like no matter what we're doing, we have a chance against England.
Yeah,
and England somehow, yeah, for whatever reason, we got England's number across the board and whatever it is that we're doing. But yeah, this Iran game is one that I think everybody has circled as something that's very scary. I've seen so many articles and videos and everything made about, like, are we sleeping on Iran? Like, we can't be at this point. Like, everybody is.
Yeah.
As, knows about like their striker and just how what they can bring to the table. And yeah, this last team, which could be I think Scotland or Ukraine, it's going to be a tough group. And it's one of those things where I've studied a lot of the past World Cups for the U.S. And I mean, that group stage, it's three games and anything can happen in three games, you know, like the U.S. beat Spain once, you know, the U.S. beat the invincible Spain. There was one game where the U.S. was, if you look at the quotes from the Spanish players, just as good as Spain on the day. And that can happen in sports. And we see that in sports every weekend. Somebody does something that you're not expecting them to do. And that could be the U.S. against England, or it could be Iran against the U.S. Like, we don't know how that's all going to shake out. So it could be a phenomenal World Cup for the U.S. It could be an absolute miserable World Cup for the U.S. I really have no idea how it's going to shake out, but I absolutely can't wait to see it all play out.
Yeah, I mean, going back to, like, just the history, I feel like there's always been a theme to the U.S. in every single World Cup. 2010, we were like the comeback kids. 2014, we were just the underdogs with a chip on our shoulder because we faced Ghana in our first match and we beat them. And then, of course, we had Portugal and Germany. Portugal were pretty underwhelming, I will say, but still a 2-2 draw. That's pretty impressive, even against Portugal. With 2022.
And come from behind. They had to.
Yeah.
I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo had to put the squad on his back.
No, that was the. Oh, my God. That dagger in the heart when Varela. I think that was that Varela or was that Ronaldo? I can't remember.
Ronaldo hit the cross.
Yeah,
I don't know who headed it in, but I remember Michael Bradley trying to run out and cover Cristiano Ronaldo in like the 90th minute, and that just, it wasn't happening.
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be fun to see what this new U.S. team is going to be. I hope it isn't just some team that's just going to let everyone step on them, and I'm sure it's not going to be the case. I mean, it's their first World Cup in over 8 years. So I'm really excited for that. I'm just excited for the explosion of fans in this next winter. It's weird even saying that because right around this time, you'd expect the World Cup to be at its peak hype. Yeah, it's like May. Like, it'd be like next month. So yeah. It's going to be really fun. I can't wait. In terms of watching the team, I'm a little shaky there, but everything else I am looking so forward to.
Yeah, I absolutely cannot wait. And then if you really want to look ahead, whenever you think about this 2026 World Cup and you think about, you know, most of our best players right now in Weston McKennie, Christian Pulisic, Tyler Adams, these guys are going to be entering their prime. You look at guys like, or maybe at their prime at that point, you look at someone like Giovanni Reyna, who's going to be, 23 years old. And I mean, just you add 4 years to a lot of these players who are around 20 years old. And then think about the quality that the U.S. is producing right now. And you add that to the mix. I mean, it could be quite exciting 4 years from now in 2026. And that's kind of what we have to look forward to. So I draw a lot of similarities between this 2022 World Cup cycle and the 1990 World Cup cycle, where 1990 was the first time in a long time that the U.S. actually qualified for the World Cup. And the reason why we qualified is because U.S. soccer won the bid to host in 1994 World Cup. So U.S. soccer put a lot of resources in getting a team together, making sure they were good to look ahead to 1994 so they could have a good showing. And they ended up putting together a team, ended up carrying more than they did previous decades and actually making the 1990 World Cup. But I believe they went 3-out in 1990. They had a bunch of very young players, young, inexperienced players. The majority of the players were like college players at that point, didn't have a lot of professional experience, but they were able to take what they learned in that World Cup, build a unit of players, add 4 years to them, and then whenever it came time for the 1994 World Cup in the U.S., they went out and shocked the world and played a lot better than anybody expected them to. I'm wondering if we're going to see something similar in 2022, where this young core of U.S. men's national team players kind of gains that experience that they need to take to 2026 in order to like really show the world what we could do. But I am hoping that we do a little bit better than we did in 1990. We get out of the group and we kind of shock the world right now.
I like that comparison though. I could definitely see like glimmers of 1994 in that 2026 World Cup. No, it's going to be exciting. I think just the entire generation, just the direction this sport is going in general. There feels like there's a much distincter direction. The game is growing more and more. It's going to have an explosion once the World Cup happens. More people are going to find themselves watching the MLS, watching multiple different leagues outside of that. Just in general, it's an exciting time.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, I hope that I hope it does happen. I hope it is a catalyst for more people coming into this game, and the continued growth of this sport. I know that we need it right now. If you're paying attention to the MLS TV deal and everything that's going on there, but that's kind of a discussion for another day. Maxwell, I want to wrap it up. I think I've taken up enough of your time. Can you take a minute to kind of tell everybody about your channel and what you're doing over there, and what your plans are for 2022?
Yeah, I'm Maxwell. I'm a YouTuber that just talks about football as basically like a little expert fan, really. I'm no tactician or anything like that. If I see tactics, it takes like 5 minutes for me to actually like understand them. But I create video essays just talking about the histories of national teams. I've talked about PSG's failures in the Champions League over the past few decades. I just have a lot of different projects I'd like to talk about. I just love talking about the emotional parts of this sport. I feel like that just is the biggest thing to me, that and just identity in general. And just in terms of 2022, I just hope I can create more of these types of videos, just learn more about the game that I may have missed out on quite a bit when I was making FIFA content. And yeah.
Yeah, and just out of my curiosity, I know you have a massive channel. You have 90,000 subscribers. You're coming to you're running towards 100,000. You're going to get that YouTube thing, whatever that is, the plaque for 100,000, and you get significant views on all your videos. What's the breakdown for your audience? Is it mostly American? Is it mostly European? Is it kind of mixed?
It's mixed. I'd say it's mostly American though. Some Canadian, a good amount UK. I think my fourth most demographic is India. But
yeah, that's
just in
awesome,
general,
man.
It's like worldwide. So it's really cool.
I'm always fascinated with just like how many American soccer fans there are. Like whenever I see like arguments go on the internet and like you assume that the person talking is like British or something like that, and you find out that they're just from Columbus, but they're using words like shite and arse for whatever reason. that's just a part of being a soccer fan in America. Anyway, I digress. Maxwell, can you tell everybody what your Twitter account is so they can follow you?
Oh yeah, so it's Maquell, MAQWELLL. The extra L because the other name was taken. So yeah, just follow me on Twitter.
And just add an L to your name. All right, tactical manager. Anyway, guys, for Maxwell, my name is Sam, and this is the Anchor Port brought to you by Bet Online.